I want to thank Dr. Joshua McSanick, who's joining us this morning. Hey, Doc, how you been?
Oh, it's been busy with COVID in the ER, but thanks for having me on again and giving me the opportunity to share some information with people.
Well, I think when we take a look at that, I know you've been busy in the ER. I was looking at the numbers from this morning. Let me get those up real quick here for you. 20 at Heron Hospital is the number I have, 27 at the Memorial Hospital of Carbondale, 4 pending. And the number of employees that are being tested or waiting is down as well. You know, it's interesting, and you may not remember this, but it carried a lot of significance the first time you and I ever spoke about COVID. And you said, look, every bed is an ICU bed if you've got the staff. You know what? When I originally heard that statement, well, I hear it differently in my head today than I did when you first said it. Doc, you got a thought here?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I didn't hear the question. So, I mean, that's the big issue that we're dealing with right now is just people being out for COVID. And, I think that's always been one of the concerns. You know, I think in the beginning, I think there's been this kind of mixed message, you know, in maybe even the national news that the masks and everything were going to make COVID kind of magically go away. And really the message in the very beginning, shortly after we originally talked, was to flatten the curve. And I think, you know, for those of us in healthcare, that's always been the big concern that we would get a spike that could overwhelm the healthcare system. And so part of that is too many patients, but part of that is also too many people out with the disease itself.
Yeah, and see, and I didn't. Doc, the first time you and I talked, I was not thinking about healthcare workers. I was thinking about patients.
Yeah, I think I'd like to think that, you know, if you wear all of the proper gear, you will never get COVID. You know, I think sometimes people don't necessarily realize that the process of putting on and taking off all the protective gear, which we call, when you take it off, doffing, is a very meticulous process, and you can still contaminate yourself on that. You know, and a lot of people are just getting into the community. You know, if you work hard, you know, for all week at the hospital, but you decide you want to have Thanksgiving with your family or, you know, go to a, you know, a social event, sometimes, you know, when it's highly prevalent in the community, you're out in the community too and not always at work wearing your protective gear.
Yeah, and then the incubation rate on that as well, adding 14 days, you could have been anywhere in the last 14 days, and you never know. That further complicates the issue.
Yeah, this is one of the most complicated things with COVID sometimes is just how long you can wait after exposure to getting it. The peak is still 3 to 5 days for many people, and honestly, who knows? With flu and other viruses, it could be 14 days as well. We've never really cared as much to look into it, but it really certainly makes it hard to know when you get sick where you got it from.
You know, it's interesting. Early this morning, I was speaking with the Illinois Department of Public Health Director, Dr. Ngozi Ezike, and we're having a conversation about treatments and saying what are the treatments she, has been hearing more success. She was talking about more and more people using the prone positions and putting people on their chests and things along that line. But my understanding is this monoclonal antibody that you are looking at here that's now received emergency use authorization, this is something that I ought to be looking at. What can you – monoclonal, first off, can you be remedial with me, explain to me what that is?
Yeah, I'll try to explain it to you, for you and your viewers. So basically, a lot of people may be on drugs now that end in the two letters AB, A-B, and that stands for antibody. And so this is the same concept of the vaccine. We're the body has B cells, which are a type of white blood cell that creates part of your defense, your natural defense system against infection. And when your body's been exposed to certain viruses or infections, it'll form antibodies to fight those off. And it forms an antibody for a specific kind of 3D structure of the virus it's going up against. So these monoclonal antibodies, monoclonal just means basically one design. And so a monoclonal antibody would be they would take some sort of 3D structure of the virus and they would make an antibody, just a single antibody against that one target. So pretty much all the newer things that we're working on getting out soon are targeting the spike protein, which you may have read about or seen on the news. And so the monoclonal antibody is a single version of an antibody that would attack and neutralize the spike protein part of the COVID virus. And a polyclonal would just mean that they took two different kind of impressions of the structure of the spike versus one.
All right. That makes sense to me. I actually get that. On the other hand, how is this created?
They create this in kind of a lab environment, so it's synthetic. And so the way I would think about these antibody things. And these are ones that when we, you know, we would have talked maybe the second time, I was super excited about. The data has not been as strong as I would have thought. Is basically we're making a synthetic form of the immune system in a lab. And so, you know, we've been using since almost day one this convalescent plasma, which means take someone who survived COVID, take some of their plasma where the antibodies live, and give it to patients that have COVID with the hope that the patient that recovers, the antibodies are good to neutralize the COVID in the person that's sick. And so basically this is a way to make us, I guess a way to think about it would be synthetic. The difference would be your own immune system might make hundreds of different antibodies against COVID, and this is going to be one or maybe two in an alternate drug. But they'll make it in a lab. So there's, you know, less infection risk, less storage risk. It's synthetic versus natural.
But also more targeted as a result.
Correct.
Okay.
Theoretically, it can be targeted at the most efficient part of the virus.
Right. So we're going after the one that we really want to go after, and the rest, well, we'll figure that out later. Interesting, and I had this conversation, and I was really regret that it was cut short. I was speaking to a woman, Carbondale, who had gone through COVID, caught it, and had been donating her plasma, and had told me in the brief conversation we had, yeah, I've donated twice, and they gave me $100. I'm like, hold on, you know, and that's all the part of the conversation that I had before they had to hang up. And I wondered if, because you and I had talked about treatments for people who are donating this plasma, I think that's something you and I just talked about to a certain extent, but it's being collected here in Southern Illinois.
You know, I know you can donate plasma in Southern Illinois, and you have been for a long time, and get paid for it. My understanding, though, is to donate plasma for COVID that we can use, that it had to be donated through CAPE, where one of the Red Cross main centers is.
Right.
So I'm not aware of being able to donate it here unless that's changed recently, because that was one of the complicated things with our patients. If we asked them, you might want to consider donating plasma for the people that have recovered to help other patients, it was a bit of a trek and a process to get signed up with Red Cross to do that at CAPE.
Right. That makes more sense. Like I said, I wish I'd had a little longer conversation. And the reason why I asked is because you tell me monoclonal antibodies, they have to be created in the lab and they're targeted. So that means harder to obtain, longer supply chain. So I'm assuming there's a little tighter criteria for who this is good for, who should be used for administering it. What is the criteria?
So I think the first thing to help, I just want to help you know, your listeners kind of understand these monoclonals and the FDA process. So because these are conversations I'll have to have with you if you come to the ER or get scheduled for this drug, is this has what's called emergency use authorization, which basically is a lower standard of evidence to approve a drug. So it's not technically approved in the old-fashioned FDA sense. And so the FDA has special limitations on who can use it based on the limited data that's out. The goal being, let's get treatments out and let doctors decide who should be able to get these or who can get these, even though the drug's not been fully approved yet, which I'm a big fan of. It makes it more complicated and difficult for me, but it's better than this sitting in a warehouse waiting while people are sick. So basically, this first study they did was only 400 people, and so there's not a lot of data, and so they're using the best, you know, criteria that we have based off this early look at if this is going to be beneficial, and it's people that we kind of know are going to have a rougher time with illness. Older people, 65 or up, people that have chronic kidney disease, people that have immunosuppressive treatment. A lot of people may be getting those outside of cancer. There's a lot of drugs now that are considered immunosuppressants. People with rheumatoid arthritis get some of these. Some people are on other immunomodulating cancer drugs for a long time now other than chemo. If you're diabetic, you would meet the criteria. And if your body mass index is 35, then that's just a kind of a way to check your weight versus your height. And you can just Google body mass index and put in your height and weight, and it'll tell you if your BMI is over 35. Then there's some subset criteria. If you're less than 65, if you're under 55, and you combine that with high blood pressure or heart disease or COPD or other lung diseases, you can get it as well.
Been a wide array of responses to this as we've seen it get a little more widespread. I mean, you talk to people going, yeah, I felt bad for a couple of days, and others, I think I'm going to die or do. That huge different response across the board age, because that's what I was thinking of. It was asthma, COPD, diabetes. And we've heard even people that blood types different. People who maybe had clotting problems in the past. When it comes to diagnosis, I do not envy you in an emergency department when the clock is ticking, when there's so many different response and outcomes.
I mean, COVID is just a real challenge. I just can distinctly think back to last year when someone came in and I looked at them and talked to them for just a minute or two and said, "You have the flu. There's no question." And they didn't believe me. And I said, "You know, it's a real change. I have to test people now for the flu, but we've been diagnosed with flu for years, and now people really want to test to prove that I'm right, because we're just that good at diagnosing flu. And COVID is just so variable, in its presentation. I mean, from people that just can't breathe to people just having, you know, vomiting or gastrointestinal symptoms, to people that, I mean, I've had some people screen positive for, you know, to have a procedure that have no symptoms. And so it's just such a wide variety. And all these risk factors are very important when determining your risk of how careful you want to be, I think. But they don't necessarily mean anything for every individual. It's just statistics. So I've seen some people, you know, very elderly, very minimally ill from COVID. And I've seen some people very young, that shouldn't be sick, get very sick. And I guess, unfortunately for me, is I see the sicker people in the ER, so I get this negative bias of how bad this is. And it makes me feel like it's a lot worse because I don't see a lot of the minimally symptomatic people. I know some of them in the community that have just had a little bit of a headache or a little bit of, they felt like a sinus infection. But I think it's very variable. And so the older you are, the more likely you're going to get those really bad symptoms. But some older people do very well. And so it's just very hard to look at someone and wonder what they have. And so I think my follow-up to that for you would be, for your viewers, if you come to the hospital, you're going to probably get tested for COVID. And you're definitely going to get tested for COVID if you get admitted, because it's so variable. We don't want to take any chance that if you get admitted to the hospital that you would be anywhere near someone that has COVID, and that you don't have COVID yourself, if we're going to put you separated from the COVID patients. So we're being very careful based on the variable presentation.
You know, what I find interesting is talking to people now, primarily in my peer group, it's parents. We're in my age group, they're worried about their parents and their grandma and granddad. And I've got a very good friend of mine who's Thanksgiving dinner, right? And now both mom and dad have it, and mom has COPD. And so he's, you know, flipping out. We'll use the technical term, Doc. And was so relieved when they'd taken to the hospital eventually at early morning hours, couldn't breathe, and that they were able to get them under control with just some steroids alone. And he was incredibly relieved and optimistic on that. I think when you look at this, as we just talked about all the different possible outcomes and you knowing which thing to match that with, steroids apparently is something I've been hearing quite a lot about. It's kind of mitigation efforts on its own level. You can go home, keep the ICU a little bit clearer, keep the hospital beds clearer, stay at home, keep the isolation in place. I was wondering your thoughts when it comes to the array of treatments, from being laying prone to you'll be fine, to here's steroids, to here's a monoclonal antibody treatment.
I think that's a good question. And I think that, you know, when we first talked, I said, you know, there's no treatment for COVID. It's all we call supportive care. And steroids are nothing new in people with severe lung infections. We've been doing that prior to COVID, the flu, COPD, everything else. There was this early concern with COVID that steroids might make you worse. And so just to kind of clarify what you said, if you have COPD, we may give you steroids and send you home because the COPD may be aggravated by any sort of respiratory illness. But for people that don't have underlying lung disease, steroids are not indicated for people going home. After they looked at many, many patients, they found that the patients that needed extra oxygen would benefit greatly from steroids. And it's made a huge difference in the criticality of illness. And getting people home and keeping people off the ventilator. But it's not been proven to help people that go home. But there is a subset of people, it's like, it sounds like the person you know, that have underlying COPD. And we give people with COPD steroids all the time, and it makes a huge difference in them getting well faster and being able to breathe and stay out of the hospital. In terms of proning has been something that's been looked at for a long time. And basically it goes to this kind of weird way that coronavirus does something to your lungs that really no virus really does. And to some extent, that's like we call atelectasis in the hospital. But if you were to look at a microscopic level and kind of take a trip down your airway, down your breathing tube into your lungs, they would get smaller and smaller, like starting at the base of a tree and going up the trunk, up into a branch. Now, when you get to the very end of the branch, instead of running into leaves, you run into little tiny bubbles like grapes And that's where the actual oxygen exchange happens. And atelectasis is when those little grapes kind of pinch off and close. And so air can't flow into those, that final destination where the oxygen is absorbed into the blood. And so when you are in one more common position, you get certain areas of the lung that just can't get any airflow anyway, the way the lung is designed to maximize airflow. And so by proning and having you lay on your chest, basically, it makes the lung do different things that it would always do to help protect the lungs and help maximize airflow and helps minimize, we believe, that to a certain extent. And we've actually had great success in medicine doing that in COVID patients that aren't on the ventilator. At first, it was just for people on the ventilator. But now we found if you can tolerate laying on your stomach or chest, that can keep you off the ventilator by helping recruit more segments of lung from getting that kind of pinched off, closed nature. And the antibodies, I'm optimistic about. We've got minimal experience with those in healthcare in general. We got 400 patients that the FDA approved it on. And I think as of yesterday, we had 20 locally. That number is going to grow substantially over the next couple weeks across the country, and we're going to have a lot better feel for, is this a game changer for us? And it's approved to keep people out of the hospital. So we're not giving that to people hospitalized. And I think the theory there is good. You want to give someone this antibody that attacks and tries to neutralize the virus before it makes you super sick.
Yeah, you're constantly looking for new. There's new things coming down the pipe for treatment, not just viruses, but other treatments all up and down the pipeline.
Yeah, there's a ton of study. There's a ton of drugs that have been repurposed that were already approved for other indications that people have been trying in COVID. And many of those are due to have some data report out, I think, over the next probably 1 to 2 months. So it's very possible we're going to get a handful of treatments in the next couple months in addition to the vaccine.
When Dr. McSanick was talking about the pneumonia, your lung has water in it. With COVID-19, the tissue is swelling. All right, so imagine now the average adult lung, if you cut it open and laid it out flat with the alveoli, which is the little bubbles and grapes that the doctor was talking about, you would cover the approximately the size of a tennis court. All right, imagine playing tennis and you know, you got your tennis shoes on, it's nice and smooth and no problem. Now imagine there's 3 inches of snow on it and the ball and the player is oxygen. How does that tennis game change when there's 3 inches of snow on top of that flesh? That's kind of how I think about this when it comes to the swelling, that you have this efficient system that is just marred, and it's really large. We interact with our environment through our lungs in a way that most people don't understand. I mean, a tennis court being touched by the air all the time, and that's the biggest single struggle, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think for the people that get really sick, that's the issue. That they just can't get enough oxygen into their blood. And COVID is a little unique in my experience too, in that people will come in with levels of low oxygen that I've historically not seen people come into the ER very often that low. In the past before COVID, if you were to come in, normally we measure something called a pulse oximetry, and 100% would be the best, but most people are between 95 and 100 depending on their age and underlying lung, condition. To see people come in the 80s would be unusual, and they would look like they can't breathe. They would look very scared and wide-eyed. And I've seen people come in the 70s with COVID and tell me they have a sinus infection. And so it's very sneaky because it can seem to get your oxygen levels very low and yet somehow trick you into not feeling as bad as people historically felt with that. And so I think that's why there's a lot of stuff. I don't want to necessarily call it conspiracy theory because the data is changing rapidly where people say, oh, they died of a heart attack, not of COVID. But this is one of the kind of sneaky things COVID does, is if you walk around for a week with an oxygen level, at 75%, and don't realize you're that short of breath because the way it's kind of fooling you, that takes a huge toll on your heart to walk around. Your heart's not getting oxygen either, and you end up having damage to other parts of the body, stroke symptoms. There's, pretty well-documented correlation between increased stroke rates and heart attack rates with COVID.
Oh.
And I think that more and more people that have been following this for a while believe a lot of that may be due to this low. You get these low levels of oxygen, which put great strain on the rest of your body, and you don't necessarily realize it right away. When you're sitting, you feel okay, but when you get up and try, I've seen so many patients come in and say, I'm short of breath all the time, but I can't even get up and get to the bathroom now. Because when you get up, like you said, and try to play tennis or do something, you need more oxygen, but there's not any extra lung capacity left to help you with that extra oxygen you need to perform any functions at all. Not even sports, but just to get around the house sometimes.
Right.